from the Theology of the Body Institute. This is
the Ask Christopher West podcast. Hi, podcast listeners.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode. We're happy to be with you today.
Yes.
Yesterday, I was mowing the lawn. We have a big enough lawn that we have to have a riding mower. And what happened to me, Wendy?
It was shocking. First of all, it was your first mow of the year.
Right.
So there was no prior experience with the condition of the mower to inform this situation.
And I just paid like $400 to have this mower serviced. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. And so there was... Tell our listeners what happened to the mower. Tell
them. Well, the mower just stopped working.
Okay. It just quit?
It just quit.
Okay.
And I was like, what the heck? It was a strange death. It was just unusual.
Uh-huh.
And so I started it back up again.
Okay.
And then there was this burst of flames that came out the engine. And thankfully, we had some maintenance people at the house working on another project. And I screamed for a fire extinguisher. These flames, like, they were shooting out of this thing.
Oh,
and the mower was close to the house.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a full tank of gas in the mower. I'm expecting some massive explosion any minute. And they got there with the fire extinguisher and put the fire out. And there was the gas tank is plastic.
Uh-huh.
And it had this big bubble, melted bubble.
Oh.
And...
It hadn't burst.
It was any moment.
Wow.
That gas tank was going to catch on fire. Oh, who knows goodness. What would have happened. Probably not the big explosion that you see on TV with cars and stuff, but I don't know. I don't know what happens when a gas tank catches fire.
I'm so glad it didn't.
And now we have to...
Maybe replace our mower.
Yeah.
Nobody likes those kinds of things. Life is like that.
Yeah, I don't
those
like those things
happen.
At all.
I know.
But I'm glad. It could have been worse.
It could have been. We didn't go to the hospital.
Nope.
No one was
whole
hurt.
House could have burned down.
We
None of that
okay.
happened.
Yep.
But it was weird, strange. Beware of mower fires, people. Just saying.
Indeed. So, that said, what else is going on in your world?
Besides mowers catching a flame.
Exactly. Moving
are
on.
Are you asking for TOB Institute
yes,
updates?
Yes,
was that
please.
That segue?
Yeah, that's right. That's okay. what I'm trying to say.
Yes, we are still in pilgrimage promotion season. Sorry. I don't know why you're laughing about that.
I've never heard that expression before. It was a spontaneous descriptor
It just came out
because
I think of my life in seasons.
Okay, gotcha.
And this is the season in which we have pilgrimages coming up.
Right.
So it's time to promote them. And so I just
came
up.
Well, here's the thing. A pilgrimage, it needs to be full of pilgrims. And say it the way JP2 said it too. So
oh, yeah, yeah.
Say
You're
it,
right.
Say
when
it.
I met John Paul II for the first time
uh-huh.
in 1995.
You were on a pilgrimage.
I was on a pilgrimage. And I had, a lot of people don't know this about me, but I had put out an album of original music called Pilgrim.
Right.
And I gave the Pope a copy of my album in 1995. And he looked at it and he said, ah, Pilgrim.
Yes, so if anybody wants to be an ah.
Pilgrim. That's right. Good memory there, Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, come with us to Italy. I am leading a pilgrimage to Italy in September. And I just found out, Wendy, you were with me when I found out.
Mm.
I should have known this sooner.
Right.
Where are we going to go?
Padre Pio's monastery
yeah.
or something like that?
I had no idea we were going. See, what do I know? We're going to Padre Pio's monastery where he lived. I've never had that part of our previous pilgrimages to
mm-hmm.
Italy.
Yeah.
So that'll be a first for me as well. We're going to do Rome. We're going to do Assisi. And we're going to do Padre Pio land.
Okay.
Sounds like an amusement park or something. There's no amusement park, I'm sure. We also have a pilgrimage in July, not one that I am leading, but my esteemed friend and colleague, Bill Dunahy, who loves drawing connections between Theology of the Body, C.S. Lewis, and Tolkien, and G.K. Chesterton. Bill will be leading a pilgrimage to England to follow in the footsteps of Tolkien, Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, and of course, loop it all together. Is that an expression? Loop it all together?
I don't know.
No, I think I'm mixing expressions. I think so. But that's right. Bring it all together with John Paul's Theology of the Body.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. So yeah. If you're a pilgrim, sign up.
Check the link in the show notes.
Yeah. I have a question for you here. It's from a patron. You ready for
it? I'm ready. Let's do it.
Okay. This is from a patron named Maggie.
Hello, Maggie.
Maggie says, thank you so much for all of the beautiful work you do on this podcast.
You're welcome, Maggie. And thank you so much for being a patron and supporting us each month.
She also says, I've learned so much from you over the years.
That's great.
I'm a teacher.
So am I.
And the other day, one of my fifth graders excitedly walked up to me and told me that he was wearing his grandma. I asked him what he meant, and he pulled out a necklace from under his shirt and told me it was an ash necklace.
Oh, dear.
He was wearing a little necklace that had the ashes of his deceased grandmother. A little later during class, he walked up again and, having unscrewed the cap, said, see, it's her ashes. My first thought was, put the cap back on, you're going to spill her. But of course, I just affirmed him and told him he better keep the cap on to keep her safe. I know that the Catholic Church does not support spreading the ashes of our deceased loved ones, and I assume it would not support the idea of ash necklaces. It got me thinking, though, we keep the bones, fingernails, hair, and other relics of the saints. What is the difference between the Catholic tradition of relics and keeping an ash necklace of someone you love?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've given it some thought. It has occurred to me, these different practices we have as Catholics with relics, which can seem a little strange to outsiders, or maybe more than a little strange to outsiders, that we chop up parts of saints' bodies and the hand will go over to this country and the femur will be in this country and the skull is going to be, yeah, that's weird. I mean, it does, at some level, it's just weird. At another level, it's very understandable and relates to everything Theology of the Body teaches about the significance, the physical significance and presence physically of the human body. It speaks profoundly of the body communicating the mystery of the person, even though a corpse is not the same as a body, and even less so ashes. But let's see if we can decipher a difference. And part of me is just kind of thinking out loud as we go here. Cremation is something that the church accepts, but does not recommend. Right, it's not immoral to cremate a body, but in a culture that already devalues the body, doesn't understand the value of the body, dismisses the body, a culture of cremation can be a culture where all that we think is important is the soul. It might be that error, or it might be the other extreme that we just think there's no such thing as a soul and the body's nothing. And so we just burn it up and spread it out in the woods or spread it in the ocean or put it in a urn or turn it into a necklace, right? It could betray, these behaviors could betray a failure to recognize the dignity of the body as the physical expression of the human person, right? Okay, so bear with me here while I'm kind of thinking out loud as to the distinction between relics and cremation and carrying an ash necklace. But let's just start with the church's teaching on cremation. The church does not teach that it is immoral to cremate. The church accepts the practice, but does not recommend the practice. It does not recommend the practice because there's an increased chance that cremation may betray a wrong attitude towards the body. So the church's attitude towards the body after death is that it needs to be honored and it needs to be prepared for the resurrection, right? Now, cremation is just really speeding up the process that happens naturally, which is that we all return to dust, right? That's what happens when you put a body in the ground. It naturally returns to dust. Cremation just speeds up that process. If we retain faith in the resurrection of the body, and everybody's body returns to dust, right? Oh, how does the body get resurrected if it's dust? Well, think about the beginning of time. What's the scriptural expression for the creation of man? God gathers up the dust of the earth and he breathes his life into it. If he can gather up the dust at the beginning of time and breathe his life into it, can he do the same at the end of time? There's no problem per se with cremation, but it may betray a failure in reverence for the body and the respect due to the body, even after death. And I would say taking ashes and spreading them abroad, certainly the church says this, it's not permitted to spread somebody's ashes abroad. It's not permitted to place someone's ashes in an urn on the mantle in your home. It has to be, if you're going to have ashes in an urn, those ashes need to be put in a sacred place where the, you know, like a cemetery, buried, or I believe, what do they call those places in cemeteries like where there was
mausoleum?
Mausoleum, maybe. Maybe we're not getting our language right here, but anyway, it needs to be held in a sacred place in preparation for the resurrection. Now, how does that differ from relics? Well, I think it is safe to say that the relics we venerate, there is a substantial portion of that saint's body reserved in a sacred place for the resurrection. I think we are safe to say that. It's not like the church would approve the complete chopping up of every portion of a saint's body to be spread abroad for relics. Right? And even then, when the church does approve of a certain relic of a saint, there is a need still for reverence and veneration of that relic. For example, the Theology of the Body Institute was granted a first class relic of St. John Paul II. Mm. And it came with a very official document. And it came with very official instructions on how to preserve reverence around that relic. Yeah. And it can't just be, you know, treated like a trinket, right? So the idea of a second grade or fifth grader, forgive me, coming into school with a necklace made out of grandma just betrays a whole way of thinking that is not in keeping with reverence showed both to, well, in whatever form, you know, the whole body or remnants of the body, relics. Either way, we're not showing the proper reverence to the reality of the body as the expression of the person, in even though it's now a corpse, but we still await the resurrection of the body, right? So I don't know that there is a drastic difference between ashes as a relic and, say, a fingernail or a bone or a drop of blood, but it's the reverence around those relics that needs to be safeguarded, and that would be my basis for distinction. This is why the church says you can't just willy-nilly do things with ashes. There needs to be a proper reverence in anticipation of the resurrection. Mm. Could we keep with proper reverence a little bit of the ashes of someone and show the proper reverence? Is that possible? Yeah, I think that's possible. I don't know that the church recommends it. I don't know one way or the other. I've never really pressed into that. So I'm not speaking in any official capacity for the church. I'm just saying in principle here, could the proper reverence be shown to those ashes? Yeah, in fact, we're obligated to show the proper reverence. The church has guidelines for that. Whether it includes retaining some little bit as a relic, I can't answer that because I don't know.
Yeah. I often remember just learning about the works of mercy, you know, the spiritual and corporal works of mercy. And I remember as a kid thinking, bury the dead, that's a work of mercy. Like, it's somehow, I wasn't sure why, you know, why is that on the list that included so many other things that seemed more obvious, like...
Like you're doing it for living people?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And plus, I think I couldn't conceive of somebody not being buried, so I didn't understand why it was even worth mentioning or something, right. You know, in that stage of life. But at any rate, I think learning about that work of mercy is a very good opportunity to teach about the hope of the resurrection, the Catholic teaching on burial, and also on funerals. There's such lack of knowledge about that anymore. I think, I know I from my parish, and I've heard it from many others, that many older people now, when they die, their family members don't even have a funeral for them. Mm. You know, it's kind of like, that's old-fashioned, and why do we need that? Let's have a slideshow and talk about the person and be happy. And the need to pray for the dead and to reverence the body and to bury a person in sacred, blessed ground.
Yeah.
That whole process of that whole life of that whole lifetime and even beyond our earthly life, reverence for the human person, I think, is expressed in a lot of these beautiful teachings on the dead.
I am so glad you brought up the corporal works of mercy. That's the key right there. The reverence that comes from recognizing it as a work of mercy and the sacredness that surrounds it. That's the operating principle in all of the church's teaching here. And it really is a lesson for us in the value, dignity, holiness of the human body. And I just want to add also for Maggie's sake, Maggie, I think you did, under the circumstances, I think you did exactly the right thing in terms of how did she say that? She just suggested that the person put the lid back on so as...
To keep her safe.
To keep her safe. Right. Yeah. Good on you, Maggie, under those circumstances. I hope what we have shared has also maybe shown a light on it for you. Mm-hmm.
Our next question is from an anonymous listener. How can I tell the difference between loving someone and being afraid of being alone? If he could be the one, how do I not let fear poison the atmosphere? I want to follow God's plan for me with a clear, trusting mind, but I often find myself questioning.
Mm. Fear is the theme here, obviously. What is motivating her entering into a relationship? Is it, I don't want to be lonely, or I want to learn to love? And I'm sure it's both. I mean, it's not good for the man to be alone, right? We feel loneliness deeply. We are made for communion, and that's certainly a motivating factor in our seeking out relationships. And it's not even something that we should be necessarily suspicious of. I think she's expressing a right caution, because there can be a certain self-motivation there that if love is only that, if love is only what you're doing for me, well, then that degenerates very quickly into selfishness. So she's right to be cautious. But I'm reminded here of what John Paul II says in Love and Responsibility, where he's distinguishing between love as desire and love as goodwill or benevolence. Mm. And love as desire is exactly this, I desire you as a good for me. I'm going to get something out of this, and I desire that. And he says, that's natural to love. We don't have to dismiss that. We don't have to even try to correct it for what it is, but we do have to mature beyond it. He says, love as desire must mature into love as goodwill or love as benevolence, so that it's not only I love you as a good for me because you're going to overcome my loneliness, or whatever the case might be, but in her case, it's loneliness. Not only I love you as a good for me, but I love and desire your good for you. and I am ready and willing to sacrifice myself and even what I see as my own good or my own pleasure or my own benefit, whatever that might be, I'm willing to sacrifice that to uphold your good. That's where love matures from love as desire to love as benevolence. And John Paul II says this is the most mature form of love, and it brings the most reward. But there's always, he says this, right, in Love and Responsibility. He says there's always some level of self-interest in love that does not itself cancel out love, right? Because there's always a benefit to us in learning how to love. But it can't stop there. So that would be my suggestion to this listener, to be aware, as she already is, of, am I in it for me? Well, yeah, we're all in it for us to some extent. There's some level of self-interest in our relationships, as JP2 says. But am I willing to allow that to mature into sacrificing myself for the good of the other? That's the journey of love. And it sounds to me that she's on it. And maybe she's on it with a heightened sense of fear, of her own fear about loneliness, and seeing it as maybe an overarching motivator. And I would just encourage you, and we all have to do this. It's such just a normal part of our experience of following Jesus that we need to learn to expose our fears to him. And it could be, I find journaling very helpful. It could be as simple as sitting quietly. I love the line of Jesus in the New Testament, when you pray, go into your inner room and close the door. So go into a quiet place, private place, close the door, sit with the Lord, and say, Lord, bring to my heart in your presence with you, Jesus, bring to my heart this fear. Help me to get in touch with this fear. Help me even in this moment with you here with me, Jesus. Help me to feel this fear so that I can open it to you in a deeper way, so that I can present it to you in a deeper way, so that I can expose it to you, Jesus, in a deeper way. And maybe some memory will come to mind. Maybe there was some childhood experience where you felt abandoned. Or, I don't know, maybe you were one of several children in your family and you felt unrecognized or unseen, or I'm just making things up at this point, just imagining various scenarios, right? But the Lord could take you back to a memory. And if you're in a place of prayer and open receptivity to the Spirit's movement in your heart, and you have a memory, pay attention to that. Even if it seems unrelated to what you're asking right away, or if you hear a song in your heart while you're in that disposition of prayer, pay attention to that. Maybe the lyrics of that song are something the Lord wants to speak to your heart, or maybe that song, as songs so often are, maybe that song is connected with some deep memory in your life that the Lord wants to bring to your attention, or maybe you're going to see a scene from a movie or remember a stanza from a poem. These are all ways that the Lord speaks to our hearts when we go to him and present our hearts to him. And that fear goes very deep in our fallen humanity. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself. That kind of fear, or fear of loneliness, fear of being unlovable, fear of rejection, all of these can become motivating factors that color the sincerity of our love and our relationships. Just awareness of that, as you already are aware, and opening of that to the Lord. And the scripture that comes to mind, of course, is perfect love casts out that fear. What are your thoughts here, Wendy?
I'm praying so much for this person and other listeners who can relate to this question. As we're just spending time with the topic, I'm thinking about how important it is to open up our hearts. And I think a person taking the time to send a question to our podcast is a person who is in a relationship, at least in this situation, where there are questions, maybe a concern about the level of attachment that she feels for this man or guy, I don't know how old the questioner is, that could be feeling like a clinging, you know, a desperate kind of attachment that doesn't feel free, that feels like there's fear behind it. So I really, really want to encourage anybody who's in a situation like that to really invite the Lord into your heart in private, as Christopher was talking about, in prayer and journaling, but also invite him into this relationship and really ask the Lord for the grace to desire his will, both for your own life and for this other person's life, to desire his will more than your own will. I think that's a hard thing sometimes when our own will is very strong and determined and the grasping because of fear is intense. That to ask for that grace, it's a prayer that we have to pray repeatedly and to feel ourselves releasing the other person to the Lord in a new way and a new grace to fill that place in our hearts that was so intent on holding on so tightly to something out of fear. So I really want to encourage any listener who can relate to this question to remember this, to pray for the grace to desire God's will for your life and for the other person's life. It gives you a whole new perspective on who that person is, regardless of relation to you. Like just in terms of God has created this person and has a plan for his life, for her life, to desire that as the true good of the other is so helpful for gaining a perspective and having discernment, openness to the Lord and what he wants to show you about this time in your life, this particular relationship, your own journey of healing. I think all those things can be helped by that intention to desire what is truly good for the other, yeah, apart from our own needs.
Yeah, and Wendy, that's a great example of moving from love as desire to love as desiring the good of the other. Mm-hmm. So we hope that's helpful.
Our next question is from a listener named Taylor.
Hello, Taylor.
Christopher and Wendy, I have had a love for the Song of Solomon and the depths his song goes to reveal love and the love of loves. How pertinent the book is named Song of Songs. You can imagine my joy when I discovered JP2's TOB and your digestible teaching of it. Binge eating is almost never good, but I have been binging your podcast nearly every day since I discovered it in early December.
Oh, great.
I'm never full, but the more I consume, the hungrier I get. On to my question. My husband and I have been married for 30 months. I've been pregnant for 24 of those months.
That's a long pregnancy.
We have two.
Wait, that was a joke. You didn't even laugh. You're just moving right along. Didn't even laugh at my joke. Now you're laughing at me being sad that you didn't laugh at my joke.
I was answering your joke with the next sentence.
Okay.
Just keep listening.
Okay.
We have two beautiful little girls and another child we lost to miscarriage. Oh. In my short time of learning about TOB, this common phrase, being open to life during the marital embrace, seems to be the crescendo and bottom line. What does intercourse in pregnancy say about the beauty and goodness of God? I know there is a mystagogy to be revealed by God and to be embraced by my heart.
Bless you, Taylor. Gosh, I love, Taylor, that you are asking this question and entering in here. I can just feel, I don't know, I feel like something bubbling up in your life, something bubbling up in your marriage, something bubbling up in your Taylor-ness that's really awesome. And I feel invited into that in a way that I feel honored and blessed. So thank you. It's interesting, this expression, openness to life, I think it's good and helpful in some ways, but it's also misleading.
It is. I agree.
It's problematic, and it's a bad translation of the original document, Humanae Vitae, which does not say each and every act, each and every marriage act must remain open to life. That's not what it says. The original Latin of the document, which is the official text from the Vatican, is that each and every act must remain per se destined to the generation of life. Per se destined, per se oriented to the generation of life. In other words, it must be the act that God designed for the generation of life, and we must not be doing anything in that act to thwart it, right? Mm-hmm. We must not engage in the act designed for the generation of children and then do something else to thwart the possibility of that generation, right?
Yes.
Another way to say it, we mustn't activate the generative power of our bodies only to thwart it. Right? You're acting at cross purposes there. So that's the teaching of the church. It got translated into English that every act of intercourse must remain open to life. And it brings up questions. Well, how can you be open to life when you've already conceived? Mm-hmm. Right? So it brings up these kind of questions. A proper perspective on intercourse during pregnancy would be to recognize that the marital act is still the marital act, and you are not doing anything to thwart the generative power when you're already pregnant. In fact, you can see that marital embrace as an ongoing celebration of the natural fruit of your union that led to that child. Right, that child is now, and if this is going to wig some people out, I'm sorry, but whatever issues in our hearts we need to work through to get to peace with this, we need to work through those issues. But that child in utero is now a part of that union. That child in utero, certainly at some level of that child's inmost being, that child in utero is feeling, is experiencing the closeness of the bond of his parents in the marital act. When that child is in the womb, there's a deep spiritual reality going on here. And talk about a Trinitarian mystery. There are now, truly, in some sense, forgive me again if this is wigging people out. I'm not trying to push people's buttons. I'm trying to speak about a delicate issue that might be so delicate and sensitive as to ruffle feathers because we just don't like to go there and think about it or talk about it. But hey, this is the Theology Body Institute channel, so it's kind of where we go. We have to talk about these things. That child in utero, when husband and wife become one flesh, when the wife is pregnant, that child is part of their union. That child is intimately involved. There's a Trinitarian mystery going on here, and through our own purifications and our own journey, we can get to a place of seeing coming together in the marital embrace during pregnancy as a rejoicing in the presence and life of that child whom God has deigned to bring into existence through the very fact that the two have become one flesh.
Mm.
That's a celebration. That's something worth celebrating.
It is. And I think that was so helpful, what you clarified about that expression, openness to life. There are different ways that it gets misunderstood, yeah, unfortunately. And certainly Taylor understandably has thought, it seems from what she's saying, that once she's conceived, they're no longer, quote unquote, open to,
right,
life. So they're,
right,
not experiencing, it seemed to her anyway, some fullness or there's a different meaning or something about this. And I think that per se suitable.
Per se destinatus.
Oh, destinatus.
Per se destined.
Oriented
per
toward.
Se oriented towards. The act that results in the generation of children.
Yes.
Not that it always does, but you're engaging in that act that God designed to do it without thwarting it.
I think a lot of that, in my mind, goes in the same line as the natural law, or when we look at the way our bodies are made, We are designed for this union, and not to treat our bodies as, you know, some kind of source of pleasure by any means, but really to fully be joined to one another as a husband and wife. So that is, at least to me, that's some of what I take from that phrasing. And it's very helpful to answer questions that other people raise at other times about, you know, what about after menopause? Or what if you just know that you have a state of infertility from various reasons? You know, what then is the church teaching in that situation? And that honoring the dignity of the body, what the Lord has revealed to us in the language of our bodies, in the message of how we're designed by God, that reveals His will to us, how it is His good desire for our bodies to be united as husband and wife, that all of that is much more the, should we say, crescendo and bottom line, rather than this thought of, I'm, you know, open to or hoping for a pregnancy to result at this time. So that's, yeah, just really helpful. It helps when people have, you know, just using NFP and they are reserving their union for the infertile time. Well, what does that mean? It's just so clarifying to explain that phrase in a better way than the connotations of saying you have to be open to life. So
that was not a flatulence that you might have heard in the background there. That was my study guide that I was pulling off my shelf.
you want to share something?
Yeah, I wanted to share something here from Love and Responsibility, but I needed to get the exact quote.
Okay.
And it did kind of sound like a fart sound, and I thought I didn't want people to think Wendy had just farted.
Anybody listening would have thought you had it.
Why?
Not
why?
I.
Why would that be on
I
me?
I think they can just figure us out already. Love.
Okay. So, yeah. So I just wanted to clarify from Love and Responsibility what openness to life means and doesn't mean, and in fact, how that phrase itself is problematic. Openness to life can make it sound like you have to positively will a child in every act of intercourse. No. Listen to this. This is JP2. Respect for the procreative end of the conjugal act does not demand that spouses positively will children in each act of intercourse. This position is not only excessive, but is incompatible with the order of nature, which admits times of infertility. Furthermore, he says, this position may disguise a form of utilitarianism, and by that he means using the spouse as a means to an end. If the only reason you are having intercourse is because you want a child, which is what a lot of people think the church teaches, you should only have intercourse if you want to have a child. No, this is not what the church teaches. You should only have intercourse if you want to express and renew the marital commitment. And part of the marital commitment is that you will receive children lovingly from God if God chooses to send them. That when you engage in the genital act, when you activate your generative powers, you will do nothing to thwart those generative powers, right? That's what's asked of us. So JP2 goes on to say, conjugal intercourse should proceed from love and is needed for love, not only for procreation. He says, the spouse's intention and attention in conjugal intercourse should be directed towards the other person, towards our spouse, towards his or her true good, and an affirmation of his or her true value.
Love that.
Yeah. Isn't that good?
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, it is not proper to direct your intention and attention during intercourse toward the possible consequences of conceiving, especially if this means turning one's attention and intention away from one's spouse. Mm. Then he clarifies, therefore, it is certainly not necessary to resolve that we are performing this act in order to become parents. It is perfectly sufficient to maintain that by performing this act, we know that we may become parents and we are willing for that to happen. Mm. This approach alone is compatible with love and enables love to be a shared lived experience. So there you go. That clarifies, I hope, what the church means in Humanae Vitae. The phrase is not must remain open to life. That's a mistranslation. But the act must remain per se destinatus, per se destined toward, per se oriented toward the procreation of life. It must be that act that God designed for the procreation of children. But it's up to God whether or not it actually leads to procreation. And if it already has led to procreation, then the marital act, when you are pregnant, when the wife is pregnant, can become the beautiful affirmation and celebration of that new life, which it should be.
And I just add to that, because I can tell that Taylor is wanting to have things to reflect on related to these many experiences in her life of union, most of which are during pregnancy so far in her life. Just to recognize, even as you look back on these 30 months of marriage, Taylor, how the Lord has been using your union to draw the best out of one another, to deepen your commitment that enables you to parent these children, to enable you to experience grace in your marriage in order to serve one another and to serve the children. So I think as you reflect back on it now with what we've shared, I hope that you'll kind of see the Lord shining light on the past, you know, 2.5 years of your married life. Is see what I was doing? See the gift I've been giving you? See how profoundly meaningful this is and how it continues to be? I think that is the gift that the Lord wants you to come away with today.
Amen. Hey, before we say goodbye to everybody, I just want to remind everyone that our son, John Paul, who's 26, has started tutoring at a professional level. I mean, he has a lot of experience doing this. He's not a newbie to it. He's been doing it for about 6 years. And if you have a school-age child, 12 or above, or if you as a young adult or adult are interested in being tutored in the fields of philosophy, theology, or literature, contact our son, John Paul, at johnpaulwest@gmail.com. And we'll have his email in the link below. He's starting a little tutoring business after doing it just kind of on the side for many years. And he's gotten great reviews from the people he has tutored. If you're in need, check out his services. He'd be happy to talk to you about, you know, if you have specific questions or whatever, just email him. And I'm sure he'll be happy to answer them. God bless you, everybody. Until next time, may you know it in your bones that you are a gift.
Become what you are.
Ask Christopher West is brought to you by the Theology of the Body Institute, with music by Mike Mangione. Christopher and Wendy hope that the information provided is helpful to you, but remind you that they are not licensed counselors. If you're going through serious difficulty, a list of trusted counselors and psychologists can be found in the show notes.